From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a voice familiar to just about everyone who listens to public radio, Garrison Keillor will tell us about life after a prairie home companion, and he'll read from his forthcoming book. For years, Wayne Horvitz was a mainstay of New York's downtown experimental music scene. Today he tells us why he left the scene, and we hear some of his new album. Also, singer Joan Morris and pianist William Balcom join us to perform some songs by Rodgers and Hart. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone remembers the first person who took her seriously as a writer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In 1987, Garrison Keillor stopped delivering his weekly reports from the fictional town of Lake Wobegon. It was a year of big changes for Keillor. He left his public radio program, A Prairie Home Companion, which he hosted for 13 years. He married Ulla Skarvet, a Danish woman who he hadn't seen since she was an exchange student in his high school. After their marriage, they spent the summer in Copenhagen, then moved to New York. It was the first year Keillor ever lived outside of Minnesota. The self-described shy person has had to learn how to be famous. He spent a week on the cover of Time magazine, surely the only public radio host with that distinction, and he's had three bestsellers. His latest, Leaving Home, just out in paperback, is a collection of Lake Wobegon stories. His forthcoming collection, We Are Still Married, will be published in April. We invited Garrison Keillor to the NPR Bureau in New York to read from his forthcoming book and to tell us what his life has been like since leaving A Prairie Home Companion. I wanted to know, as one radio person to another, what it was like to actually leave the show after so long.
It's a jolt. It's like walking off a small cliff. It's hard on your lower back. it's a great surprise.
Do you miss the adrenaline and do you miss the deadlines?
I was kind of running out of adrenaline. That was my problem. And I wasn't getting nervous enough. So I took a layoff, and now I do the occasional show in a theater and walk out on a stage, and I'm pleased to report that I can get scared with the best of them. I get so scared I forget the second verse of Hello, Love, which I always used to think was sort of engraven somewhere in the base of my brain.
Did you ever have a terrible moment of second thoughts after you left doing the show regularly and say to yourself, oh, my God, what have I done?
Oh, I had 100 of them. I had 100 of them. I went over to Denmark pretty smartly right after the end of that thing. We just bought an apartment in a section of Copenhagen, and there wasn't a stick of furniture in it. And I was going to language class, and so I went from all of these encomiums and farewells and all of this affection of the audience over to sitting in a bare room in Copenhagen and then going down to a bare classroom and talking about knives and forks and, you know.
Oh, is it language study?
Where is my suitcase?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the bathroom? So it was a long fall there, but it's exciting. You know, it's good for you. It sure gets your attention, and I recommend it.
Recommend what? A big change?
I do. I really do. I think that somewhere in there, around the middle of your 40s or somewhere, a person needs to go up in a plane and jump out of it or do something dramatic.
Well, you know, when you're doing something on a regular basis like you had been doing with Prairie Home Companion, I think it's easy to convince yourself about all the great things you'd be doing if you gave it up, if you changed your life, on all the things you'd be doing if you just had a little bit more time. In your case, I'm sure, writing figured into that agenda. Once you had the time, were you able to do all the things that you wanted to, or did they become more difficult than you expected?
They always were difficult. I didn't imagine that writing a novel would become easier because I had more time to sit and look at blank paper. But I still wanted to do it and am doing it and intend to finish it. And in the meantime, I've been fooling around doing some writing for The New Yorker and doing some shows and this, that, and the other thing. But I did want to write this book. I'm working on a novel. It's set in the early 50s and at a radio network, a small radio network in the Midwest. And all these people like you and me and our friends in radio, the bottom has dropped out of their world. Television has come in over the horizon, and they're all just about to be out of work. And that's what I want to write about.
Now, this will be your first published novel. I think I remember a story of you writing a novel that you kept in a big box under your bed, and you eventually threw it out.
I did. I put that into a landfill somewhere in Minnesota. I doubt people are raising much corn where I planted that thing. It's pretty deadly. Should be a law against that, probably.
You've still been writing Lake Wobegon short stories.
Yes, I do. I still am curious about those people, and so I still write about them so that I can find out what's happened to them.
I guess I was surprised that you were still doing that. I kind of thought that when you gave up the show that you'd also give up the characters. But I guess, as you said, there was more to find out.
Well, there is a lot more to find out. I'm not publishing them anyplace. I haven't so far. Don't really have any plans to. But mm-hmm. But I do sit down and write on them.
I was wondering if Lake Wobegon was a way out of writing autobiographically for you, a way of putting everything you knew into your writing without implicating the living.
I sure implicated a lot of the living, and it's only recently that my relatives will start to confide in me again now that I'm not on the radio on Saturday nights. Some of them will actually tell me a few details of their lives. They were afraid, and rightfully so, that they'd become material. When you do a weekly show and you intend to tell a 20-minute story as a part of it, you become hungry for material, and you use anything that happens around you without shame. So, I miss doing those stories because they were a way of putting into making they were a way of making sense of just about anything that happened to me. I could make it happen to somebody in Lake Wobegon, and they would somehow figure out things that I was unable to myself. So I miss that. I miss doing those stories. I'll sneak back into it someday. I'll get some early morning show on some little 250-watt AM station up in northern Michigan. You know.
My guest is Garrison Keillor, and by the way, his bestseller, Leaving Home, is out in paperback, and he has a new book coming out in a couple of months, another collection of short stories called We Are Still Married. Let me ask you to read something from the new collection, and before I ask you to read it, I should say that I think one of the reasons, well, I know one of the reasons why you left doing A Prairie Home Companion was because of all the attention that the press was paying you and the intrusiveness that you felt. It was causing.
Are you asking me?
Well, I guess it was a statement with a question mark at the end, wasn't it? But you mentioned at the beginning of Leaving Home that what happened was you had bought a new house, and while you were out of town, the house and its address was printed in the newspaper, and I think the price that you paid for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this seemed to you like a real invasion of privacy, and that you were paid much too much attention to. That had a lot to do with your leaving, right?
I left because it was just too strange to to live in St. Paul, which I wanted to do and intended to do for the rest of my life. I was really too old to leave, I think. But, you know, in order to make somebody into a celebrity, you have to put them at a distance. And that's just too painful to do in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's not that big a place, you know. You keep running into people at the grocery store and in church and restaurants and so on. I ran into the editor of the newspaper in a restaurant. We both liked the same restaurant, and, you know, she's kind of embarrassed to run into me. She sort of apologized. And so it's just too odd, you know. It's a strangeness that leaks into your life. It's like a bad taste in the drinking water, and you move away. Go someplace where you can be anonymous. And the big city. People have been moving to the big city for hundreds of years for the very identical reason: to be anonymous,
mm-hmm.
just to be individuals. And it's a sweet thing.
I'm going to want to ask you about moving to the big city, but first I'd really like it if you did a reading from your forthcoming collection, We Are Still Married.
I will now do a reading from my forthcoming collection. What would you like me to read forthcoming?
If you could read an excerpt of My Life in Prison, which has already been in print, and which magazine was it, Garrison?
That was in that Atlantic. Do they still call it the Atlantic Monthly? Or?
I'm never sure. I just call it the Atlantic myself. I think monthly might be vestigial at this point.
I see.
But I think this is a really funny piece, and the part you're going to read really comments about being the center of all the publicity.
I don't know. I'm not sure if this is funny or not. I never am clear on that. Tell me if I come to a funny part.
Okay.
Ever since the day I first walked out on stage and blinked and cleared my throat, people have written some terrible things about me that aren't true, but it doesn't matter. I've done a lot of terrible things in secret that nobody wrote about, so it all evens out. My sister used to say terrible, untrue things about me to my parents, but it didn't matter because they didn't believe in innocence anyway. When they caught us pounding on each other, they just grabbed the nearest one and sent him up to his room. And if I said she hit me first, the truth, it made no difference. I still got punished to make up for the times they probably had made a mistake in my favor. Their punishment backfired in my case. I loved to be sent up to my room. My books were there, my tablets, my plastic soldiers. It was good up there. If they wanted to punish me, they should have sent me out to play with other children. Solitary confinement was my idea of fun. It was a chance to sit down and talk to myself, and that's what naturally led me into radio, which led to so much more, including those terrible, untrue things. This is the sort of thing I mean, which happens often. A reporter calls up and says how much he's always liked my work. Could he take me to lunch? So he does, something expensive like walleye sushi, and he asks me 10 questions about life and love and laughter. And then he turns on his tiny tape recorder and asks, "What's the worst thing your folks ever did to you?" I tell him that sometimes they punished me for nothing. And he writes his story, Rich Writer, Bitter Toward Mom, 74. I understand. He's only doing his job. There's nothing personal about the piece. Journalism is a moral art. It draws pictures in bold strokes. The newspaper columnist back in St. Paul, who combed the town for children whom I had disappointed, is a deeply moral writer. The man who wrote, "Timmy lies in pain while Hero laps up New York glitz and glamour." A very sick little boy lies on a broken bed in a dank basement apartment on the south side, waiting for hours for the mailman. A few minutes after 1 o'clock, when he hears the rustle of mail in the fetid hallway, he climbs painfully from the soiled sheets and limps to the door and stops with his little hand on the cold knob and says an Our Father, but so far it hasn't been answered. Every day, Timmy whispers Garrison Keillor's name and looks for an envelope containing the autographed photo he requested from the former Prairie Home Companion host way back in March 1987. Doctors say that such a signed photo could give Timmy the spark of hope he needs in order to live. His aunt Brenda says if only Garrison knew how much it means to us, surely as a Christian he would spare 30 seconds to autograph a picture. But would he? Keeler, who sleeps all day and spends his nights cavorting with the glitterati in the niteries of Sodom, is said to be quite satisfied with his new famous friends and his new life of luxury and excess. I read that story and suddenly realize why PR people send out gallons of Johnny Walker at Christmas and serve prime rib sandwiches in hospitality suites and hotels. Journalists are hungry people. The PR guy, courtly, English, walks up to the sleaziest writer in the room and lays an arm across his dandruffy shoulders and murmurs, "You know who you remind me of? Edward R. Murrow. I mean it. You've got that same intensity, that kind of grace, like what Yeats wrote about. How does that line go? Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds, a lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. Can I get you a scotch?" The reporter, a man with watery eyes and 40 pounds of old cheeseburgers around his waist, blushes and stares down at his hush puppies. And for the next 20 years, you will have no problem with him at all. He will go chase the university president, tax money lavished on executive suite while the dying lie in dim alcoves at U Hospital, or snipe at the archbishop, prelate fails to attend cripple's dinner for third year in row, or haul off and slug the mayor, politician denies persistent rumors of pet molesting. And he will not go writing these stories full of everybody who has a grudge against you. He'll write, "Everyone in this town knows Garrison Keillor is a wonderful entertainer and devoted father, but I wonder how many of us are aware of those dozens of little unsung deeds he does for the poor and unfortunate every week." A PR guy would sing some of those deeds in a nice low voice so that a columnist could hear them. I don't have a PR guy, but once I did hire someone named Milo to attend rehearsals and yell, "All right," every time I sang a song. I was sensitive about my voice and needed affirmation in order to do my best. He sat among the band, and in that awkward silence after a song when the musicians reached for a smoke, Milo yelled, "All right, far out, whoo, you sang that one all right." Milo is quoted in my biography as saying that I was selfish. That's a sad story. Hard life.
I should say that the story that you just read from is called My Life in Prison, and it will be included in your forthcoming collection, which is called We Are Still Married, and that's scheduled for publication in April on Viking Press. I want to talk with you more about what life is like for you now, the kind of post Prairie Home Companion years. But first, we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Garrison Keillor. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Garrison Keillor, and although he no longer hosts the weekly radio program, A Prairie Home Companion, he has been taking the show on the road, and he'll host the third annual farewell performance in Los Angeles on June 10th. Keillor is also a staff writer at The New Yorker, and his new book, We Are Still Married, will be out in April, and his latest book, the bestseller Leaving Home, is out in paperback. In the monologues that you've done over the years, you've really told us all a lot about yourself, although the names have been changed. But in the last few years, you've had to do so many interviews that you've really had to, I'm sure, draw some kind of line between what's public and what's personal in your life. And I've been wondering if that's a hard line to draw and where you've decided to draw it.
Well, my wife says that I don't draw it as tightly as I should. And she and I talk about it at great length. It's an interesting question. A writer does use things that happen to us, I don't know of any other way to write about these characters other than to carry over my own experiences into their lives. So it's a predicament. On the other hand, I have a family, and I have a mother and father, and brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles who I don't care to embarrass, which I certainly have in writing like Woebegone Days, for example, which I wrote a great deal in the first person, and I wrote about fictional aunts and uncles and a mother and father who I considered fictional in the book, but people oftentimes read that as a factual autobiography. So it's a problem that I don't have an answer for.
Mm-hmm.
But ever so often you run the risk if you're a writer, maybe you'd write a story and use a first name for a character, and then months later, years later, run into an old friend who had that same first name, and the look on her face of pained, poisoned politeness, and you know something's wrong, and you find that your fiction went awry, and you hurt somebody whom you loved.
I'm interested in where you draw the line between public and private for the press when you're doing interviews. And I'm interested in this both as someone who is an interviewer and as someone who has occasionally been interviewed. I mean, now, in your case especially, you made headlines for your marriage, for marrying Ulla Skarved. And, I mean, that's a very personal thing, deciding to get married, especially, when you're in your mid-40s, when it's later on in life, and everybody wanted to know about it. Your listeners wanted to know why you were doing it. The press wanted to know, and you had to decide: well, what's for the public to know, and what's just personal.
Mm-hmm. Well, when people ask me questions, I try and tell them the truth, and what I've tried to do when I have gone out on stage. I don't wear a costume when I go out on stage, and I do talk about a town that people know to be fictional, and yet when I tell them stories, and especially if I talk in the first person, they assume it to be the truth, and it is. I don't go out and play a character on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that if if a reporter asked me a personal question, I'd probably look at them and answer it, which may be a mistake. I don't know.
You told us before that you came to New York for the anonymity, and although you wouldn't have anonymity exactly in New York, there's lots of famous people in New York, so famous people are slightly less fussed over, I think, than they are in a lot of other places. New York's a big change for you, aside from the brief amount of time you spent in Denmark. The only place you ever really lived was Minnesota. And I'm thinking that New York is a much tougher place. Probably there's a lot more crime, and everybody in New York knows that they have to walk with this real assertive style so that you're not picked on or mugged. And I wonder if this has affected the way you walk down the street or anything?
It hasn't. I don't feel that way about it. I think since I moved to New York in the year and a half that I've lived here, I think that at least 20 people have walked up to me and said, "Excuse me, but your billfold is sticking up out of your back pocket," or words to that effect. And it's true. I mean, I walk around town like a Midwesterner. I stare up at the tops of buildings because the sidewalks aren't that interesting, and with my billfold sticking out of my back pocket. I'm not affected by it at all. I don't feel afraid in New York at all. I think that the fear that people feel about New York is a fear felt in our behalf by people who live elsewhere and who can imagine how dreadful and frightening it must be. But in fact, I feel much more frightened in smaller cities when I need to walk someplace and I suddenly find myself in this barren urban terrain of parking lots and vast open spaces and dimly lit side streets. That's when I start to get nervous. In New York, I'm surrounded by crowds of people. There may be a lot of panhandlers. There may be sad and crazy and unfortunate people, and you may find it depressing, but I don't feel it dangerous at all. Not really.
One quick Denmark question. When you were living in Denmark, and you couldn't really speak the language, I was thinking about what that was like and thought that perhaps the most difficult thing would be not being able to have a sense of humor, because that's the most complicated part of language, using irony or humor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get other people's jokes and they can't get yours?
Jeg forstod en lille smule dansk humor.
Breaks me up.
Ikke det alt. Ikke det alt. Det er meget ironiske mennesker. Yeah.
I think our listeners around the country are probably curious about what your touring schedule is like. Are you making a lot of stops nowadays with the touring show that you've been doing?
No, I've just been doing a few. I did a show with the Chicago Symphony over Valentine's Day. It was most fun. What a great symphony it is. And I did some songs with them and did a long piece called A Young Lutheran's Guide to the Orchestra. That is... it's a lot of fun to do. I did a story about Lake Wobegon. Then I lay off and I'm going to be writing for a couple of months, and then I'm going to do a long tour for the third annual farewell and take the Prairie Home Companion troupe across the country and play a lot of cities that we've never played in and always wish that we had.
Well, I wish you the best, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Tara.
Any chance you'll ever do the show again on a weekly basis?
Is Hope something? So.
You do?
Hope so.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Garrison Keillor's new book, We Are Still Married, will be out in April. His third annual farewell performance of A Prairie Home Companion will be held in Los Angeles on June 3rd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with country singer Willie Nelson. I hope you can join us. This is Garrison Keillor from his cassette Prairie Home Comedy.
Well, come along, boys, and have a glass of cider. I'll tell you what it's like to be a freelance writer. Come a tie, yippee, yippee, yay, yippee, yay. Come a tie, yippee, semicolon. Well, writing is easy and the money is great, but it's hard to know how to punctuate. Come a tie, comma, yippee, quote, come a tie, parenthesis, yippee, parenthesis. Well, I've written great stuff. Editors reject brilliant work, but it was incorrect. Comma tie, comma dash, yippee, yippee, dash, yippee tie, comma yippee, period.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we hear from the president. Not George Bush, we mean the band called The President. It's led by composer and keyboardist Wayne Horvitz. We talk with Horvitz about his band and about the Manhattan experimental music scene he helped create. Also today, songs by Rodgers and Hart, performed in our studio by pianist William Balcom and singer Joan Morris. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone remembers how one college class and one college teacher changed her life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. B. Dalton, the nation's largest bookstore chain, announced tonight that it, too, is removing Salman Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses, from shelves of its more than 1,200 stores nationwide. Yesterday, Walden Books became the first bookseller to take such action. NPR's Mike Schuster has details.
B. Dalton has never pulled a book off its shelves, the company's head said in a statement released late today. According to the statement, the action was taken to protect the company's employees and patrons. There have been many threats at bookstores around the country and at Rushdie's American publisher in New York, Viking Press. Viking locked its doors today and will not reopen until Tuesday. The company is installing additional security devices. It has received 9 bomb threats since December, 2 of them just this week. The action by B. Dalton will mean that any remaining copies of the Satanic Verses will be removed from shelves in all B. Dalton and Barnes & Noble bookstores. Yesterday, Walden Books took the same action in stores in 660 cities. The book is sold out in many other shops. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Opening statements in the criminal trial of Oliver North are scheduled to begin Tuesday morning in Washington. Problems over the use of classified documents have been resolved. The retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel wants to make public sensitive material in his defense, which the government says will damage national security. At issue is what the government will say in a statement on how the Reagan administration obtained foreign military help for the Nicaraguan Contras at a time when Congress banned such assistance. A federal judge in Brownsville, Texas, today lifted a temporary restraining order which had prohibited the Immigration and Naturalization Service from imposing travel restrictions on Central American refugees seeking political asylum in the U.S. We get details from NPR's John Burnett.
Today's order means that the INS can resume a controversial policy that was suspended 5 weeks ago. Central Americans coming across the Rio Grande seeking political asylum in this country will not be allowed to continue on to their cities of destination, such as Miami or Los Angeles, while their cases are being processed. Attorneys for the Central Americans say they'll appeal. They warn that the policy will force refugees, many of whom are destitute, to sleep in the open and beg for food. The Justice Department is studying a proposal to house the applicants in a camp near the application facility and provide them with food, housing, and toilets. The idea behind the policy is to decrease the huge backlog of asylum applications by keeping the refugees in South Texas while their cases are expedited. 11,000 Central Americans, most of them Nicaraguans, have passed through Texas and applied for asylum in the last 5 weeks alone. The new policy takes effect Monday at midnight. In Austin, this is John Burnett reporting.
The U.S. today evacuated about a dozen Americans from the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The airlift came as the Lebanese army and Christian militiamen fought scattered battles throughout East Beirut, where the embassy is located. The Americans were flown by military helicopter to Cyprus. The State Department said only that the evacuation was prompted by renewed fighting within the eastern part of the city. A new ceasefire announced yesterday seems to have slowed the fighting, in which more than 50 people have been killed. The United States today vetoed a Security Council resolution that strongly deplores Israel's actions in the occupied territories. The vote on the resolution in the UN was 14 in favor and 1 against. The Security Council resolution comes on the heels of a UN Human Rights Commission condemnation of Israel issued in Geneva. The U.S., Canada, Britain, and several European countries opposed that resolution, which accused Israel of savage human rights abuses in the 14-month-old Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 12 points to close the week at 2323.57. Advances led declines nearly 2-1 on volume of 159 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1971, 4 years before they were married, pianist William Baucom and mezzo-soprano Joan Morris teamed up to perform a wide variety of American popular songs. They've since made several acclaimed recordings, ranging from turn-of-the-century parlor songs to the work of America's greatest musical stage composers. Baucom and Morris will be our performers-in-residence for the next few weeks.
One day, Richard Rodgers was invited up by Robert Kimball to talk to Kimball's class at Yale about the musical theater. And they talked a long time. And, of course, in those years, Rodgers was writing very busily with Oscar Hammerstein II, and all of his recent shows were, of course, big hits and had been in everybody's memory. And he was very surprised with Rodgers because the students all wanted to know about Rodgers and Lorenz Hart. And he says, why are they interested in all that old music? And, of course, Richard Rodgers is almost like two different kind of composers. When he wrote for Oscar Hammerstein, it's much more kind of middle America, solid. When he wrote for Lorenz Hart, it's a little bit more complicated. And this next song is that kind of psychological complexity, I think, that maybe the young students at Yale must have been so fascinated by. Glad to Be Unhappy by Rodgers and Hart.
Look at yourself. If you had a sense of humor, you would laugh to beat the band. Look at yourself. Do you still believe the rumor that romance is simply grand? Since you took it right on the chin, you have lost that bright toothpaste grin. My mental state is all a jumble. I sit around and sadly mumble. Fools rush in, so here I am, very glad to be unhappy. I can't win, but here I am, more than glad to be unhappy. Unrequited love's a bore, and I've got it pretty bad. But for someone you adore, it's a pleasure to be sad. Like a straying baby lamb, with no mammy and no pappy, I'm so unhappy. But oh, so
Larry Hart has always been one of my favorite lyricists because the words just seem to speak so well. They seem so personal. And they're also very good to speak just as, you know, with my students, I'll do them as acting exercises, and they speak naturally. He really caught speech rhythms. This is from Babes in Arms, I Wish I Were in Love Again.
You don't know that I felt good when we up and parted. You don't know I knocked on wood, gladly broken-hearted. Worrying is through, I sleep all night, appetite and health restored. You don't know how much I'm bored. The sleepless nights, the daily fights, the quick toboggan when you reach the heights. I miss the kisses and I miss the bites. I wish I were in love again. The broken dates, the endless waits, the lovely loving and the hateful hates, the conversation with the flying plates. I wish I were in love again. No more pain, no more strain. Sane, but I would rather be Gaga. The pulled out fur of cat and cur, the fine mismating of a him and her. I've learned my lesson, but I wish I were in love again. The furtive sigh, the blackened eye, the words I'll love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes a lie. I wish I were in love again. When love congeals, it soon reveals the faint aroma of performing seals, the double crossing of a pair of heels. I wish I were in love again. No more care, no despair. I'm all there now, but I'd rather be punch drunk. Believe me, sir, I much prefer the classic battle of a him and her. I don't like quiet, and I wish I were in love again.
Next week, William Baulkham and Joan Morris will perform the music of George Gershwin. This is Fresh Air. Mid-70s, keyboardist and composer Wayne Horvitz and some of his musician friends like John Zorn, Elliot Sharp, Butch Morris have been major players in the new music scene in downtown Manhattan. Horvitz writes music influenced by rock, blues, jazz, non-Western music, and the avant-garde. Horvitz leads several bands. His new album uses rock instrumentation to play his compositions. He calls this band The President.
Well, originally I named it the President of the United States, so that we could go on stage and people could say, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. And then it got shortened. Everyone's called it the President for short, and that kind of stuck.
So what was it like to have your dream come true? At the beginning?
Well, since we were playing, usually it's CBGBs for eight people. It wasn't all that exciting.
To me that you don't want your music, though, to be a series of references or homages to different kinds of music that you like.
No, in fact, completely opposite, and I've never tried to have any influences. I mean, I've never heard something and thought, oh, I've got to incorporate that. Well, I shouldn't say never, but you've never heard me do that, because every time I've tried, I've always thought it was a miserable effort, and I've thrown it out. I mean, you know, occasionally, like, people always talking about gamelan music being an influence, and that's true, but once in a while I've tried to write a piece that actually was influenced by gamelan music in a more literal sense, like to use a gamelan scale or a rhythm that I heard, and I've always thrown it out, you know.
You know, also, like some composers who are influenced by so many different kinds of music play some of it with a lot of irony,
right.
Which I don't think you do.
No, and I'm completely uninterested in irony in music, which is interesting because I'm interested in irony personally a lot. I mean, in my own sense of humor or my relationships with people or conversation, I'm often ironic, and I kind of that never gets to my music. I mean, I work with a lot of people who work with irony, and also I work with a lot of people who use genre and references as a specific element in their composition. John Zorn's an obvious example. And I enjoy doing that with him, but I have no desire to do it in my own music.
Well, how come?
I guess I'm more interested in a direct emotional expression, though, I mean, even to say you're interested in an emotional expression is kind of absurd. I mean, I'm not interested in it, it's just what I want to do, you know?
What relationship do you see your group, the President, as having to what's become known as fusion, jazz fusion, which is...
Well, there's two words I hate. One is fusion and the other is art rock. I don't know. Fusion to me was people playing a million miles an hour and sort of what I call jock jazz, you know, where everyone's trying to... You know, it's a very chops and technique-oriented mm-hmm. music, and I think there were a few good versions of it. I mean, I liked John McLaughlin, whereas I didn't like what Chick Corea did or lots of other bands in that idiom. I liked early Weather Report, and I liked the Electric Miles Davis. You listen to the Electric Miles Davis, and although it was called Fusion at the same time that Chick Corea's band was called Fusion, and they aren't related at all. I mean, Miles was doing this incredible kind of montage of sounds, all simultaneous and very subtle, you know. Now, that appeals to me, but that's not what people usually mean when they talk about fusion. Fusion usually means kind of jazz playing technique over rock rhythms, and the President doesn't do that at all. The President's much more, it's really through composed, except for one odd soloist here or there.
What does the expression through composed mean?
Well, it means that there's the drummer and the bass player aren't sort of improvising on a rhythm. They have parts. Everybody has parts. And there's sections to the tunes. The lengths of the improvisations aren't open, and the structures are totally predetermined.
You've done a lot of free improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what a free improvisation session is like from your perspective?
Well, I mean, for people who don't know what that means, it just means that you sit down and play. I mean, you don't have a tune, you don't have a composition. But I kind of divide improvisers into two categories. Those who just sort of do what they do and everyone gets together and plays at the same time. And then the other half, and these are the people I like to play with, are the ones who keep their ears wide open and try to compose spontaneously on the spot so that a piece is really made.
What are the pleasures of that kind of playing?
Oh, it can be immense. I mean, I think occasionally you hear music in free improvised playing that is, I don't know how to say this, but sort of higher than any music I've ever played or heard in my life. Then there's always the problem that it doesn't necessarily last. I mean, often you'll hear you'll go to a concert and people are playing free, and within a half hour you'll hear something for a few minutes that's really more brilliant than anything you've ever heard, and then it'll be dreadful for a while. So you take more of a risk, but the potential is fantastic.
For years, you were one of the key members of the New York downtown experimental music scene. You've recently moved to Seattle. Why did you want to leave New York?
Well, I've always wanted to leave New York. I've always wanted to stay there, so I sort of tried to do both. I mean, it's mostly I hate to use this word, but a lifestyle thing. I just was tired of living in a crummy apartment and struggling constantly.
Were there things when you first moved to New York that seemed very appealing, maybe even romantic, about New York and about the experimental music scene there that started to seem less desirable after a few years?
Well, the scene's always been important. The other part of your question, absolutely. I mean, I've always said that it felt to me like the first 6 or 7 years I lived in New York, I really, musically, I was really struggling. I mean, I had very few opportunities, but I just loved being in New York. But I think I was at an age where I could stay up all night, too, and there was sort of a scene and all that kind of intensity. And then after a while, I really was only there because of my career, and I suddenly looked around. I couldn't understand why anyone who had sort of a regular career would want to stay in New York. I mean, you come to a place like Seattle, and people go, you know, why would you leave New York? It's touted as sort of this place like no other place, and basically everyone's music is inside their own head, and of course you take that wherever you go. But then I go back there sometimes, and it's great.
Thanks a lot for doing the interview.
Okay, my pleasure.
Wayne Horvitz's new album, The President, is on Nonesuch Records. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Noah. What's coming up?
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, we have a reporter on the streets of New York City trying to find a copy of The Satanic Verses, the book, controversial book by Salman Rushdie. Walden Books, as you may have heard, has removed the book nationwide. He found one. It was hard to do. The independent stores are selling out. Most of the chains don't even have it in stock. Also, we'll talk with Mary Bond. She's 90 years old, the widow of James Bond, the ornithologist, from whom Ian Fleming borrowed a name for his now quite famous hero. And we'll meet three members of a bluegrass group called Blue Rose, five women, all with independent careers. Good music, great harmonies from Blue Rose.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Kate Millett's book of essays, Sexual Politics, was one of the seminal works of the women's movement. Several years before its publication in 1970, Millett was teaching English at Barnard College in New York City and also working as an artist. Critic at large Laurie Stone was one of Millett's students then and recalls how she was shaped by Millett's example both inside and outside the classroom.
When I was growing up, I wasn't encouraged to do serious work. I was expected to marry a man who would support me. My parents said, "Go to college and become a teacher." The idea being that I'd have that job in case my husband died. I imagined my mythical spouse perishing under a steamroller, and teaching seemed a punishment career. The word education itself became tainted. In graduate school, where I studied English literature, the seminars were dreary. Later, hearing about the tenure struggles of friends, academe seemed even more small-minded and dispiriting. But a few weeks ago, filling out an application to an artist's colony, I wrote an autobiographical statement, and a classroom from my past vividly returned. The brilliant teacher was Kate Millett, and I had the luck to be her student in the mid-60s when I was an undergraduate at Barnard. Kate surveyed the classroom of girls before her, the usual array of eager, scrubbed faces and cynical show-me types. She meant to expand our horizons and to teach us to think for ourselves, because she knew from her own experience that no one very likely had ever taken us seriously. She worked harder than any teacher. She sat behind her desk with her inevitable bun and industrial-strength brown skirts, and in each class spread enough notes before her to fill 5 lectures. She riddled us with commentary and questions in that peculiar accent of hers, half Midwestern twang, half affected British from her 2 years at Oxford. Her weekly conferences lasted an hour, and she'd cover essays with passionate scribblings. While other teachers stuck to rote curricula, Kate studded our course with avant-garde authors. "What, you haven't read Tropic of Cancer, you poor benighted child?" she'd say with a laugh. I didn't care whether I understood her references. The important thing was that she was full of thought she felt intensely about, and she made us feel our thoughts could matter too. She let us glimpse the world of art. She came to Barnard, redolent of downtown and Bohemia. "I'm a sculptor," she'd say. Once, she invited us to see a show of her work, which was mounted in the basement of her house, a lopsided wood building on the Bowery. Stools, dinnerware, mannequins, everything was painted ash gray, as if it were covered in fallout. The exhibit was so solemn it was comical, the way Kate could be sometimes. In the 50s, Kate had been smitten by the Beats, by their rebellion against orderliness and straightness. She hung out at Max's Kansas City in the Cedar Bar, attaching herself to excited, boozy moderns. But they were men, and she wanted them to recognize her. Eventually, she realized she would never be real to them, and the knowledge that women must recognize their own worthiness and that of other women stoked her teaching and eventually fueled the women's movement. I was impressed by Kate, as she had been by the Beats, but in her, I had the advantage of a mentor who did think I was real, someone of the same sex whose footsteps I could follow. "Go, kids," she said to us, without ever saying it, because she was shy and formal. I trusted her when she said I had something to contribute. Her classroom changed my life the way only great teaching can.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Mohawks and Modems. We'll talk with science fiction author William Gibson. Gibson's credited with creating a type of sci-fi called cyberpunk. It mixes high technology and fantasy with a youth culture sensibility. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from alto saxophonist Oliver Lake. And television critic David Bianculli previews Timeline. It's a new public television series that recreates great moments in history from the perspective of an on-the-scene reporter. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.